Hello.
Well, hello, sir. How are you, my friend?
Hello, Mega Panda.
Hey, hey, hey.
It is good to hear your voice. Are you ready for, oh my God, the future of love?
Oh, indeed. Let us love.
I mean, I heard a couple of women yesterday saying, I don't want to say this on our public recording here, but here we are, what can I do? I was in the shopping market, and they said, Ken Wilber, he is the future of love. I don't know what that's about, Ken. You got it going on out there.
Well, it's certainly true, and I'm glad to see they're plugged into
the unfolding and evolving waves of true consciousness. Oh, my God.
Indeed.
Oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, this is exciting.
It is.
This is exciting.
It's great. It's the beginning of a terrific series. We have an enormous number of really gifted teachers lined up here to share their thoughts on this topic, and we're going to kick it off here, see if we can't outline certain broad themes, and then sit back and let this thing unfold.
That is completely fantastic. And yes, this is really the, for everyone listening, this is the opening both of the Future of Love teleseries, which has 25 unbelievable teachers who have been in dialogue, you know, with Ken, I think, you know, over many, many years. You know, some of them who I've had the privilege of, you know, playing and dancing with in dialogue, and who have really been in deep, you know, kind of their own work. Each one has made a really significant contribution, you know, themselves to the world. And so I think, you know, the kind of reach of this series is actually unbelievable, and it's going to be one of the things we look back on. This was a kind of a seminal series in trying to really see and understand and participate in unfolding the trajectory of spirit, where goes the future of love. And this is also the kind of laying the groundwork conversation for integral spiritual experience too.
Indeed.
Which is like, wow. Well, ISC1 was so great.
Yep.
I mean, I think your biggest line, Ken, was happiness squared. I mean, the room, just as you said that, into the room, I mean, you could just kind of feel the kind of the depth and the falling into the space. And it was such an incredible space of we that was created at the kind of gathering of Integral Experience 1. And we're so ready for, you know, ISC 2. And I think there's going to be like 750, 800 people, like a gathering of the tribe from all over the world.
Right.
It's really exciting.
Right. It is. And like you say, the first one went not only well, I mean, I sort of hate patting ourselves on the back here, but I have never heard superlatives about a conference like that one. People were just blown away. It was just absolutely amazing from beginning to end. And it really was itself an epitome of love and the miracle of we.
No.
There was an extraordinary we space created. It was filled with love, and it just took off from there.
Yeah, no, that really is what happened. And each of the teachers that came, you know, brought, you know, such a depth, and there was such a rich diversity from, you know, Krishna Das, who was bringing his, you know, kirtan and send you an email afterwards saying, you know, I can't believe I was at Ken Wilber's conference with Neem Karoli Baba on the stage with me. there were bisections of worlds, and, you know, Surya Das and Jean and, you know, Diane and Sally, and, you know, it was just a fantastic, and the staff, I mean, Nicole, Kelly, you know, I mean, did such a fun, just really a great, great, you know, kind of sense of, and that's how you really know it's happening, that there was really love all the way up and all the way down. It wasn't
right.
Just kind of in front of the room there was love, but kind of, you know, the staff was all killing each other, but actually it was really the opposite. Really at every level you had, you know, McLuhan's true intention of the medium is the message kind of fulfilling itself. So it was really a gorgeous explosion of both integral depth and love.
Yeah,
yo.
Absolutely.
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 So we are now gathering for the future of love, integral spiritual experience. And, you know, you talked about the miracle of we in passing. And I thought maybe, Ken, what would be a better place to start as we kind of begin to enter into, you know, the love space, but not in the kind of, you know, with all due respect to everyone, but not in the kind of saccharine, new age, hey, let's just all hang out way, you know, where kind of there's not a sense of what's the depth interior experience. Because, of course, when we talk about love, you know, just the words themselves don't mean much. It means, you know, what is the depth of consciousness that lies beneath the words is, of course, from an integral perspective, what it's all about. So maybe we could just begin, you know, with just hearing from you, you know, something about the miracle of we that you spoke about in integral spirituality. And what is this miracle, and why is it so significant?
Yeah, to begin with, integral theory maintains that every event can be looked at from at least four major dimensions. And that's an individual and a collective, and then also from the interior and the exterior. So putting those together, we get the interior and the exterior of an individual and a collective. And the interior of an individual is what you see when you introspect. It's your own individual I or me or mine. And if we look at your individuality from an objective perspective, then we would see the scientific view. We would see an organism with a triune brain and two kidneys and two lungs and so on. And that would be an objective view of your individual. But your individual is always part of one or more groups. There's just no such thing as a singular without a plural.
Mm-hmm.
And so these groups themselves can be looked at from the inside, in which case you have its values, its morals, its center of gravity, its worldview, and it can be studied from the exterior, in which case you have the objective plural systems that make it up, whether these are environmental systems or social systems or the infrastructure that makes up any particular group or society or nation. And what love is, really, is the lower left quadrant, the interior of the collective. So love is the positive glue that ties together any relationship. And so any relationship forms a we.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's so important about this we is that it's intrinsic to being. It goes all the way up, all the way down. And if you want to take sort of a spiritual view of this, when spirit manifests itself, it doesn't just manifest as a separate group of individuals and with insides and outsides, and then they may or may not get together. It manifests as individuals that are intersubjectively woven together. So that spirit, it's true, is looking through the eyes of each individual, but it means it's also looking through the eyes of all relationships that are formed. So when you are with a loved one, you have not only your finite self looking at each other, but there is an infinite self, a true self, a unique self that is looking at each other, that is resonating with each other, whether you're directly aware of that or not. And so this we space is indeed a space that exists on the ordinary finite realm, but it also exists on the spiritual infinite realm. And so it's an absolute miracle that human individuals can display mutual understanding, for example, or can look at each other and say, yes, I understand what you mean. And, oh, yes, I see that. Or, yes, I understand what's going on. How on earth could these two separate minds reach this space of mutual understanding? The basic answer is because the spirit manifests in a we space. It manifests not only as an I, and not only as an objective it or its, it manifests as a we. Every we that you are in has a spiritual resonance, has a spiritual glue holding it together. And that glue is indeed called love. And love is the sort of the basic concrete of relationships, whatever they are, whether they're fraternal relationships or parental relationships or the relationship of one spouse to another, exist in this we space.
Mm.
And it's a miracle that this we space exists at all, and that it could exist, and is without spirit to explain it. I just don't think he can really explain it at all.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, that's just so fantastic. And just to recapitulate for a second, I mean, you know, and you've talked about this in other contexts, you know, so that what you're basically talking about is a miracle of we, which is a direct confrontation with spirit itself.
Right.
With, I think, how did you once say it, Ken, with your own deepest self peering back at you, like
right.
being in front of a mirror.
Right.
right? I mean, which is just so unbelievable. And I think just to pick up for everyone, you know, with Ken's last sentence, which is, you know, it's kind of a miracle that this happens at all, meaning that if we lived in a world which was only flatland,
right?
If we lived in a world in which we were only separate selves, skin encapsulated ego,
right,
then we would run into Heidegger's problem, you know, lecturing in the 20s in Germany, which is that ultimately there's a chasm of loneliness and separation that simply cannot be traversed.
Right.
Because there's actually no shared quality. So the best we can do, you know, to borrow a modern phrase and retroject it, you know, the best we can do is we can create win-wins. You know, we can create, you know, social covenants, you know, and contracts that allow us to somehow navigate, which are all important, which are all real, and need to be honored. You know, Hobbes, you know, correctly reminded us that, you know, the state of living in harmony in a social contract is a lot better than the state of war. But ultimately, that which allows people to actually feel into, right, and empathize and actually identify, right, and even expand their own sense of self to include an other.
Right.
Because that's really what love is. Love means, you know, I've expanded my sense of self, which was narrow, and now that I love you, right, something's happened. And it's before I met Ken Wilber. You know, I remember when I first read, oh, God, a decade back, I read No Boundary.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in Jerusalem, and someone had a copy of it on the table. I said, what's this? They said, oh, you know, guy Ken Wilber, book No Boundary. So I said, okay. I picked it up. You know, now before I read that book, Ken Wilber didn't exist in my world.
Right.
Never heard the name. Never, you know, I read the book. I was blown away. It's an unbelievably gorgeous book, you know, No Boundary, right? And all of a sudden, what happens is, Ken's entered my world, right? And there's a relationship. And then when we actually met each other a couple of years ago, right? And then, you know, as a relationship deepens, all of a sudden, right, what happens is that, well, if Ken's having a bad day because I love him, right, it completely affects my world, not for pragmatic, strategic reasons, not because there's some contractual issue we need to work out, but because he's entered my space, and we're actually in a shared space, and we've entered the space of consciousness together, which is one,
right?
And so therefore, we're directly, profoundly affected by each other, and we can, all of us who love each other, can cause each other ecstasy, or of course, the flip side, great pain.
Right.
I mean, that's the we space.
Exactly. And, you know, according to Flatland philosophy and science, you can't even explain or prove the existence of other minds, let alone another mind entering into yours and creating a we space. But according to integral theory and according to any sort of multidimensional view of the situation, what's happening is that in each individual, the same true self is resonating. And since this true self, there's only the overall number of true selves in the universe is but one. It's true self, true spirit. And since that same true self, true spirit is looking through your eyes, that's looking through my eyes, then there can be a connection. Because ultimately there's a oneness.
That's
ultimately, you and I are one. But we are also participating in manifestation. So there's a separation as well. And the true self in you appears as your unique self, and the true self in me appears as my unique self. Same true self, simply appearing in different sentient beings. But because it's ultimately the same, because it's ultimately one spirit driving this, then you and I can share perceptions. You and I can have mutual resonance. You and I can agree with each other or disagree. We can know each other because it's the same spirit doing the knowing.
Right, and which is just so unbelievably gorgeous and brings us really to the kind of unfolding implicit part of integral theory that we've talked about for a number of years, which really emerges, as you implicitly say, from the conversations around unique self, which is to move our understanding of love from an emotion that kind of bubbles up, kind of happens to you, and the kind of old Greek notion of being love-struck or blinded by love or
right.
struck by Cupid's arrow that hits you and, oops, it hit the secretary. Right?
Right.
In other words, it's this thing happening to you. Right? In this understanding of love, love is actually an awakened capacity of realization. Right? And in the intersubjective space, that awakened capacity of realization, right, that awakened capacity of realization expresses itself as a perception of the other's true self and unique self. And it's to see you clearly, I perceive your unique self and I perceive your true self, meaning love becomes not an emotion but a realization, perception, an awakened capacity. So therefore, all of a sudden, it's something we can train. It's something we can develop as opposed to this kind of strange, cruel Greek god that happens to us.
Yes, and I think that this is the point to mention that love can appear and does appear differently at the different levels of consciousness or different levels of development. And what you're describing is what it ultimately is, which is this relationship from ultimate self to ultimate self. And the love and the bonding that comes out of that unity in duality, that oneness in manyness. And that's the ultimate drive of love, even in its earlier expressions. But it does have earlier expressions. And we can use, for example, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy, which moves from physiological needs to safety needs, to belongingness needs, to self-esteem needs, to self-actualization, to self-transcendence. And there's a type of love that goes with each of those. So at the safety level, one gets into love relationships looking to be made safe, looking to feel comfortable, looking to be in a relationship where one isn't challenged or threatened. And it's basically a relationship of safety. You make me safe, I'll make you safe. We won't hurt each other, we won't grow, we won't change, we won't do any of that. When we get into belongingness needs, now all of a sudden it's, well, now you are part of my belongingness needs, and I'm part of your belongingness needs. So we help each other create the sense of belonging. We don't do anything that will detract from that belonging. And so we move in a mutual resonance, sort of lockstep, of just belonging with each other, belonging with each other, belonging with each other, and not doing anything to upset that. And then we move to self-esteem, and now all of a sudden they're starting to get a little bit more growth factors in here, and we're starting to see a little bit more of the ultimate nature of love starting to shine through. But self-esteem is, I am loving you as part of my self-esteem, and you are loving me as part of your self-esteem. And so we are doing things for each other that helps increase each other's esteem, each other's self-concept, each other's feeling about themselves, and doing things that will basically help that and will help move that along. And in some cases, it can be somewhat uncomfortable, but this commitment to self-esteem is enough to help move that forward. And then there's self-actualization needs. And here, love truly blossoms because self-actualization is the need, the drive, the demand to find one's deepest, fullest potentials and actualize them. And so here, entering into a love relationship becomes a means of actualizing my own deepest potential, and driven by love. So it's now love becomes, has a bit of a duty to it to help me find my deepest potentials, to help me love that, and to help you find your deepest potentials and to love those into existence, so to speak. And so now love is part of the self-actualizing individual. And is what is helping them bring forth their own deepest possibilities. And these come to fruition in self-transcendence. And this is love, as you were just explaining it, this is love of one unique self for another unique self.
That would be self-transcendence and, or self-realization, kind of.
It is a self-realization.
Yeah.
And it's caring for each other and helping each other find the awakened estate, the enlightened estate, and resonating most strongly with that enlightened awareness and helping to move away from lesser states, less realized states, less fulfilled states, and staying in a self-transcending state, which means that you're moved beyond the separate self, whether it's an accurate self-concept or a false self-concept, into the true self,
right,
which is the self which is infinite and eternal, spaceless, timeless, ultimate, true self. And that will appear in each individual as their unique self. And so now, all of a sudden, love is resonating with the joy of infinity and is resonating with the quality of eternity. And this is a spiritual love in its fullest sense. And that is what is now driving the relationship. And that's what is helping each individual move forward in that relationship and is really plugging in to that spiritual source and core of the entire spectrum of development itself. And so it starts to come to fruition in these spiritual capacities.
Now this is so wonderful and so important, and really what you're describing and what we're really talking about in the integral community, which is why we're so excited to really get together with the kind of tribe, to use a frame, you know, tribe as a kind of purple word, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of levels of consciousness, whether that's your colors or Don's colors or Suzanne's level, you know, that kind of tribal sense kind of which exists at a second tier. So it's a tribal gathering at second tier. This gathering that we're inviting people to,
right,
is no less than not just the celebration of, but the participation in the evolution of love.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, really what Ken's just described, right, from a particular perspective, using Maslow's hierarchy, you know, is the actual evolving of love, in this particular case, within the life of the individual. And, of course, the evolution of love, right, takes place not only in the life of the individual, but in the life of, you know, the lower left, in the life of the collective. And what that means is, I mean, just I want to kind of say it for everyone in a really clear way. You know, when the World Trade Center, you know, that just terrible, terrible 9/11, you know, we all kind of remember where we were. You know, when you look at the one of the most kind of stunningly just beautiful and heartrending, you know, things that came out of that were the transcripts of the cell phone conversations of people, you know, as they knew the plane was going down.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, no one called to say, hey, you know, sell short. You know, no one called to say,
right,
my picture, you know, in the right place.
Right.
Everybody called home and said, I love you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what people were doing. I mean, and that's, and I love you is really, you know, when we've killed all the gods, Aphrodite remains. You know, we kind of have this intuitive understanding as we emerge into a, you know, a post-postmodern integral world spirituality that love is at the core.
Right.
And yet at the same time, the word love has been so degraded and so, you know, kind of expanded in its usage that it kind of fails to mean anything. And what integral evolutionary world is really saying is, right, is that I love you actually means something based on your level of consciousness, based
right,
on where it's coming from.
Right.
That I love you by itself is beautiful but insufficient, right? Right.
Right.
Love is, after all, you know, emerging and emergent from, you know, where is that statement coming from?
Right.
And which is why, you know, a couple can be in a conversation with each other, and one says, I love you, and the other one hears it, but it doesn't impact.
Right.
Because there's something in it they're not believing.
Right.
There's something in it that's not actually resonating with them. Right. They're actually hearing that I love you as you're my security needs. They're hearing that I love you as, right, oh, I love you meaning, you know, I've got a place to belong.
Right.
I love you meaning you're actually providing the self-esteem that I need.
Exactly.
I love you, you're helping me realize my actualization goals.
Right.
Right. Which are all legitimate. Those are all part of the story, but the evolution of love that we're inviting ourselves to and people to, you know, in this series and at Integral Spiritual Experiences, can I actually, in my life, and can we as a community, right, actually receive, honor, the benefit of every level of consciousness and its unique contribution to loving, and then transcend end the trance of each one of them and include them at the highest levels of love, right, which have everything before them, but actually make love mean something entirely different.
Exactly. And that's where love comes into its true flowering and its true form. And that's when it's self-transcending, infinite, eternal, unending type of love. And those aren't just sort of, you know, philosophical sounding terms. It's when your heart breaks open to infinity and you find yourself in a relationship that you recognize yourself in.
Right.
And that's because you're recognizing the one spirit that is driving the relationship. And then all of a sudden you can see this not only in your own I am-ness, which is where you can feel spirit in your own I am-ness. You can feel your true self, your unique self in your own I am-ness. But if you're in relationship with somebody then and they're feeling their I am-ness, you can feel spirit in them. And it's the same spirit you feel in yourself. And so that bond of love becomes extraordinarily strong because in the biggest sense of the word, it's self-love. It's loving this one and only true self that is the only self in the entire universe. And the whole point of human existence is to wake up to this one true self, this one true spirit. And when you are in a relationship, then that can be part of the drive to wake up to that one self, that one spirit. And you do it because you are so enamored, you are so taken, you are so smitten with the other person, you can start to see right there in front of you what your own self is like, what your own spirit is like. So it makes it easier to fall into that spiritual realization when you are in love. And
right.
That is the glue of that highest realization. It's the drive of that highest realization. And so all of a sudden, love becomes both the drive towards this highest realization, it becomes the manifestation of this highest realization,
mm-hmm.
It becomes the glue of this highest realization, binding all apparently separate selves together into one awareness, one consciousness, one spirit, one realization.
Right.
Where love reaches then to the ends of the world and
right.
And beyond.
Right. I mean, and the only thing you can say to that is oh my God.
Exactly.
And it's oh my God. I mean, love is in that sense, the incarnation of divinity, and what we've unfolded, in the unfolding, evolving, evolutionary integral understanding is that this notion of love that emerges from true self doesn't, however, for example, allow the guru to say, you marry this person, you marry this person, you marry this person,
right.
Which happens in many communities because you all participate in the same true self, because true self then merges into or emerges from true self, unique self, and so that actually the notion of a kind of unique bonding, a unique coupling of a special relationship that was so derided, in many spiritual circles, right, because they understood the special relationship being a function of ego.
Right.
If you, for example, read The Course in Miracles, one of the things that's most attacked is what they call the special relationship, because that's understood as being a function of ego.
Right.
And of course, it can be. It can be at the level of safety, at the level of belongingness. But actually, when we're looking at it from an integral perspective, first, we actually allow place for all the levels of the spiral because they're all legitimate. So
right.
A, having, a sense of safety and belonging is not a bad thing.
Right.
Let's start there. You actually need that. That's what Maslow meant when he said, you actually need your basic safety to be taken care of before
right.
You get to actualization. So we don't want a spiritual bypass here.
Right.
At the same time, we also don't want to stop at true self and say, well, true self means since the total number of true selves are one, well, that means you could actually be with anyone. It doesn't really matter who you pick. We actually recognize, right, that actually you're a unique self, meaning love is a unique self-perception, and that actually there are, what we might call an affinity of souls, is the way the old text talked about it,
right.
The sympathetic affinity of souls, and or the sympathetic affinity from a Buddhist, framework of perspectives. There are people whose perspectives actually do fill out your own. right, do move you and provoke you to your next level of growth.
Right.
There are people that you can actually share vision with in ways that you can't share vision with other people. So actually developing the faculty of perception as a unique self-perception that emerges out of true self, right, actually is very important, you know, which is why you actually want to be in places with people who actually share something of your perspective and worldview. I mean, we're expecting, Ken, at least 50 people to meet and fall in love.
Exactly, right?
Because you know, when you enter an integral world space, it's very, very hard to then talk to someone. Of course, we can love everyone in a broad sense, but you actually want someone who shares, you know, a worldview with you, and you can actually look through somewhat of the same eyes and actually be in a conversation where you're sharing the same operating system.
Right.
Yeah.
You're sharing the same form. Well, the form is what you are attempting to exchange and attempting to understand, and you're doing so with the same true self. But
right.
Now, the true self is has always been understood as the union of emptiness and form.
Right, Nagarjuna.
Exactly. And so the emptiness is the same in all individuals. That's the part that's one spirit, one self, one and only, one and all. But then there's the manifest side of the street, and that's the form side of the street. And the fact of the matter is, the form side of the street evolves. And the form side of the street is slightly different in every sentient being. And therefore, the union of emptiness and form in your own true self is actually a union that can be found in no other sentient being anywhere else. So it's a unique self that is the true meaning of true self. So it's still the same emptiness, the same true spirit in the terms of emptiness that's present in your beloved. But the world of form is different. A slightly different perception, but it's one that you can resonate with. It's if you fall in love with this person, then you're falling in love. Not only is it emptiness to emptiness and one spirit to one spirit, it's also those aspects of form in the other person that you love, and those are unique. You won't find those anyplace else. So you can have a special relationship as long as it is grounded in one spirit, as long as it is grounded in self-transcendence, as long as it is grounded in emptiness, and then recognizes some of the special features of this other individual. So it's not at all contradictory to say, I love every human being on the face of the planet as my unique self, and I love you so much, I want to marry you.
That's right. That's right. And this is one of the places that you know, the spiritual world, particularly the world of realization and enlightenment, didn't take hold in the broader culture because there was a lack of sufficient discernment, right, between levels of consciousness. And so just like when people would say, you know, hey, if you think you're special, you're locked in ego, and then people would still retain, even after all the sitting and all the zazen and all the shikantaza, they'd still retain a sense of specialness.
Right.
And the teacher would say, hey, we'll go sit some more. But the person would kind of feel this intuitive kind of dis-ease because they actually understood that they did have a sense of specialness, which was, of course, their unique self that wasn't being recognized. So the same kind of epistemological confusion and the same kind of existential, emotional confusion happened to so many people that we've spoken to over the last few years who kind of heard this thing that you can't have a special relationship. And of course, that teaching was, of course, a partial teaching. Whenever parts become wholes, they pathologize. And the teaching was, you know, as you've said so elegantly, you know, if your love relationship is merely, right, a way to get your safety and belonging needs met, right, if your love lists, you know, if you make a list of who are the people who give you egocentric security, then you make a list of who are the people who you love, and you find out that there's the exact same people on the list, you might want to check into that, right? Because right? Because your love list has become, right, your egocentric security list. Having said that, that doesn't mean that once you, of course, once you ground in true self, you know, as you've, again, I don't want to repeat it because it was so beautiful, but just everything you've said, you're grounded in true self and you're seeing spirit, you know, through your eyes in the other, at that point we realize that form actually expresses uniquely, and that therefore there can be a unique match between us, not the one and only. There could be 10 possible unique matches, but there is actually a resonance, and actually doing the work to clarify your ego. Then to realize true self is actually probably the best way to find your unique partner.
Exactly. And then love can become a way to continue your spiritual growth. If we say that spiritual growth begins with the intuition of our unique self and continues through to the full-time realization of our unique self,
right,
then that's an overall spiritual path. So if you recognize, if you in a relationship with somebody that you love and you have this intuition of spirit in them, a direct spirit-to-spirit realization and understanding, then that relationship of specialness in terms of love can become a way of overcoming specialness in the wrong sense. It can be a way of growing through the needs into the highest self-transcending need. It can be a way of transcending ego, and you transcend ego then in that relationship because you're always willing, both of you, to submit to spirit. Because
right.
Both of you recognize that highest self. And so you have a means of working with a relationship. You have a way of going. Is that really the highest you? Because it's not the highest me, and I don't think it's the highest you. You can call each other according to the terms of this spirit that's the same in each of you. And one of you, though, might legitimately say, you know what? I hear what you're saying. I see that being different for you. The form side of yourself expresses itself that way. But I want you to look at what I'm doing here. Mine doesn't express itself that way.
Mm-hmm.
But my unique self expresses itself a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
In the world of form that it has identified with in this particular body mind. And can you help me see that? And if not, I'll grant you that I'm just being probably egoic. But let me put it that way first. And can't you help me see that? And so the unique self actually becomes a way of stripping the relationship of any of its, quote, uniqueness in the Course in Miracles sense, any
right.
of its specialness, any of its egotisticalness, and so on.
Right. Right.
That actually is based on recognizing the unique self. The Course doesn't really give you anything adapted to your individual being.
That's right.
It's all the same.
That's right.
And so there's no place for the unique selves to have different perceptions and different ways to approach this.
Right. This is, you know, when we kind of look at this and try and, you know, unpack it, it seems like, you know, three things come out, you know, and emerge in a really exciting way that we could just kind of say as kind of simple statements. You know, the first statement would be, you know, we could say to ourselves, you know, and out loud, you know, our love lists are too short. It's just a really nice thing to say. Our love lists are too short.
Right.
Our love lists, once we actually understand this notion of what integral loving, integral relationships is about, we realize that actually we confused our love lists with something else, with our safety lists, our belonging lists, et cetera.
Right.
You know, two, we actually begin to see that actually modernity in its flatland form has created egoic love as the modern idolatry.
Right.
Right. And we actually need to, you know, kind of iconoclast, you know, to kind of shatter that icon, but not by the removal of love, but by the evolution of love.
Right.
You know, that's our kind of second step. And maybe from there, I want to pick up on one thing you said, Ken, and maybe we could try and just look at what might be kind of the salient characteristics, you know, just as an initial foray into this territory. And I'll throw out a few, and maybe you could comment, accept, reject, deepen, you know, all the things that you do, Mega Pandit. You know, just a few characteristics of a second tier integral relationship, right, as opposed to kind of a first tier locked in one of, you know, Maslow's earlier
right.
you know, levels relationship. So maybe the first, go ahead, please.
Right. Well, first of all, second tier is where you begin self-transcendence. You begin to realize that your truer self is actually part of a system. And it's part of some people view it as Gaia and see it as part of this great web of life. And others just see it as part of a social system. But they start to actually feel that their selves transcend this individual body-mind. And, of course, by third tier, body-mind drops. And there's a direct identity with everything that's arising moment to moment. And that's those are the transpersonal levels or structures. But even beginning in second tier, one of the defining characteristics of second tier is that because it is starting to transcend the individual self, it transcends any attachment to, in a sense, its own viewpoint. The definition of first tier values, and that would be all of Maslow's needs, including physiological safety needs, belongingness needs, self-esteem needs, and self-actualization needs. The definition of all of those as first tier is that they believe their values are the only correct values on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to second tier, there's an understanding that all of those values have some truth to them.
Right.
And so the person at second tier, first of all, has an enormously increased equanimity and tolerance. So there is an enormously increased capacity to tolerate the shenanigans of your lover.
Right.
And so you can start, so your love starts to take on that great deal of equanimity and, in a sense, easygoingness and tolerance and okayness, in addition to its joyful bonding and unification in a relationship. There's also an easygoingness about it. There's not the tendency to jump on the other person all the time. Is, you're just not seeing it right. I'm seeing
right.
it right. You're not seeing it right. I don't know why you always do it, but you always do this. That just drops away. One of the things that Clara Graves found drops away at second tier too is fear. Fear tends to dramatically decrease as the self moves into second tier. And I think one of the reasons, of course, is that you're starting to have less identity
right.
with the relative self.
Right.
So less fear about what's going to happen to it. And of course, when you move into third tier and separate self drops entirely, then fear drops entirely. But it begins to drop at second tier. And so relationships are not so much the place where there's the arena of love that is a kind of love and hate. And we know how many of our romantic relationships, we say it's a love-hate thing. They love
right.
each other, they hate each other. That's very, very common with first tier
mm.
because you're locked into having, just your view be correct, and therefore sooner or later you end up just, having an explosive moment of hatred for the other
right.
person. It's like, you just drive me crazy. I don't know how you can believe that.
And you feel your very survival is threatened.
Very much, because your separate self is threatened.
That's right.
And at second tier, all of that tends to drop away. And so there's much more a mutuality in the love resonance. And this is where love can particularly start to become a path of growth, because both of you start resonating with this great deal of tolerance, and that's the beginning, of course, of resonating your one true self, resonating your one true spirit that is starting to explicitly recognize that it's showing up in the other person. And so now your love is starting to take on, as Maslow would put it, the characteristics of being needs as opposed to the characteristics of deficiency needs.
Mm.
And boy, is that a good way to put the difference between love at first tier and second tier.
Love at first
tier is deficiency.
Right.
I lack something. I lack belongingness, and you are going to give it to me. I lack self-esteem, and you are going to give it to me. I lack self-actualization. You are going to give it to me. Now, all of a sudden, you become the source of my deficiency needs. You're, in a sense, merely the prop of my deficiency. And so I'm always going to end up defining you in a deficiency situation. And if you don't fulfill that deficiency, then fuck you.
Right, as it were.
Exactly. We get into second tier, the needs, the motivation there, Maslow called being needs. And those are needs of overflowing, of abundance, of being motivated by just so much of something that you're moved to share it with the world. It's like being given $1 billion. First thing you do is you go share it with your friends.
That's right.
You're not struggling for a dollar here or there. You're no longer deficiency.
That's right.
When it comes to money. So all of a sudden when you hit second tier, it's like you're given $1 billion worth of love. And it's just flowing out of you. And so it's flowing out of you into your special relationships. It's flowing out of you into the whole world.
To the whole world.
It's also flowing out of you into these, quote, special relationships that we've seen can be used for good or bad. But here can start to really make them be used in a good sense. Because now you don't want something from the other person. Now you're simply giving to the other person. And so now you're both overflowing into each other's basket and no longer simply demanding and deficient and grasping and wanting. And so the nature of love takes on an incredibly different tone altogether, which is not, you know, I'm really deficient in this. Can you help me? Oh, I love you so much for doing that. Thank you. Two, I have so much of this. Can I share this with you? Because I love you so much. And it becomes this fulfilling superabundance. And that is truly the beginning of one spirit starting to shine forth in the miracle of we and starting to resonate in this love space of we. It makes an extremely, you know, truly amazing shift from first tier to second tier.
I mean, it just changes. I mean, literally, it changes the entire fabric, you know, of both the planet being and the entire fabric and meaning of what love actually is. I mean, just that great, you know, beautiful image that you know, $1 billion of love,
right,
you know, flowing from you.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, so if we would just kind of look for a second and just feel into, you know, with everyone listening, you know, the difference between what we're calling first tier relationships, first tier love, and integral relationships or second tier loving, the differences, you know, are just enormous. We've moved from a kind of grasping, egoic, separate self that's desperately kind of clinging to the other to get its needs fulfilled,
right,
to an expansive, authentically grounded, you know, powerful being, you know, brimming, flowing, you know, overflowing with love as an expression of his or her true essence.
Exactly.
And everything changes as we move into being needs, right? We move into being needs. We actually then begin to also support each other's true becoming, because our becoming is not a way of covering over our emptiness. And I mean, maybe one nice way to say this, just to give people a really clear way to hold it, is maybe the difference between the silences of first tier and the silences of second tier.
Yeah.
You know, silence at first tier is so often a silence of absence.
Yeah.
Right? It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking for words to cover over the emptiness. We need the social structure of words to navigate the contract. You know, we need the social structure to overcome the feeling of not belonging. It's that long, uncomfortable silence. You know, it's a first tier date where, you know, at the end of the date, you know, it didn't work too well for either of you. And, you know, you get into the car and there's 7 minutes left and you both want to press the eject button, you know, and a silence, you know, falls on the car. And it's the most uncomfortable silence in the world because there's no longer, you know, words to paper over, you know, the emptiness or the insecurity or the lack of belonging or the lack of self-esteem or the lack of actualization.
There's no mistake in the fact that the other person did not supply your deficiency.
Right, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's so clear that
now
it didn't work.
It.
Now you know it. And so therefore your efficiency, right, exactly. So your efficiency is so accentuated because you kind of papered it over. But now in its not being met, it's so jaggedly apparent that it's embarrassing to be in the same car. And so you're kind of looking for that eject button, but it's just not there. But
yeah.
Then, you know, when you meet at the level of true self and unique self, you know, when you actually participate in your own evolution, which is the evolution of love, which incarnates in you, as you, and through you.
Right.
And you then meet that moment of silence, and you know you're at the end of that same date, you know, and there's, you know, 7 minutes left, you're in the car, and silence descends on the car. It's not a silence of absence, but it's a silence of presence.
Yeah,
you know,
fullness.
Yeah, I mean, you might even actually, you know, borrow Maslow's terms that you introduced. You know, it's not a silence of deficiency, right? It's a silence of being.
Yes.
Right? It's, you know, in other words, you don't need words because somehow words in some way get in the way of the emergent quality and presence of true self and unique self that's just so available that you can actually bask in it as the $1 billion of love, you know, flow through you. So the difference, I mean, so silence is just a nice way to look at the difference between, you know, a first tier, right, and an integral relationship, you know, and these differences, you know, are the kinds of things that we actually want to try and chart, you know, both in this Future of Love teleseries and as we go through Integral Spiritual Experience 2. And it's, what is it actually, what are the 10 demarcating characteristics, and to really have a discussion on each one of, you know, what it means to be in an integral relationship and what it means to be in a pre-integral relationship. I mean, just throw out one more example. I mean, what's the difference between commitment at first tier, at the different levels of consciousness, and commitment at second tier?
Yeah, and commitment in first tier is a mutual agreement pact to offer each other what they most desperately need.
Right, right.
And so, okay, we're committed to doing that, and I'm committed to it because I'm going to give you what you need because I can't stand the thought of not getting what I need. I can't, because I can't live with my deficient self. I have to have somebody fulfilling that deficiency need. And so as long as I know what you want so that you'll stay here and fulfill my deficiencies, then I'll give you what you want in order to fulfill your deficiencies. So we get in this, it's a mutual agreement pact. It's a mutual agreement to help cover over each other's deficiencies. And so we will be together as long as you are fulfilling my deficiencies and I am fulfilling your deficiencies. But we get to second tier and commitment becomes just the ever-shining nature of recognizing the same true self staring back at me in another person. I realize that I feel somehow deeply that this is the same spirit in both of us, and might even say, my, you know, because without, if I'm not sophisticated and I don't know psychological or spiritual theory or something, I might just say something like, God, it's like, for some reason, it's like meeting my highest self when I'm with you. And
right.
It is.
Right.
Your highest self is staring back directly at you. And so your commitment here is to both manifest that highest self. It's a commitment to be in love from that place of authentic sharing, where I'm not giving something to you because you need it. You're not giving something to me because I need it. We're giving something to each other because we can afford it.
Right, right. And that, I mean, that's fantastic. And the place that we see the differential, with the place that we see it actually appear differently in the world. And in Aramaic, they would always say, Lamai Nafkamina, in the 3rd century, meaning, okay, so how does this practically express itself in a different way, whether you're in an integral frame or a pre-integral first-tier frame? So I think there's really two expressions which are very powerful of what you just described, Ken. One is divorce, right?
Yes.
Right? I mean, first-tier divorce, right? Since we're each meeting each other's survival needs, if you fucking dare, right, to threaten my survival needs, even though we've been together for 10 years and had 4 kids together and had a million moments of loving, you know, my divorce lawyer is going to tell me to change the locks. I'm going to attack you, malign you, right, do everything I can to destroy you because you were giving me my very sense of existence. And
right.
Since you're now divorcing me, my sense of existence is threatened, so I need to do to kind of reclaim my existence and my power from the perspective and experience of separate self, everything I can do to destroy you.
Right.
Which is modern-day divorce.
Well, it is.
As a first-tier expression.
And it's one of what we look at in terms also of modern relationships, which is, for the most part, a mutual sharing of deficiency needs.
Right.
And then the we space becomes a space of deficiency needs. And so we all of a sudden, the we space itself starts to take on characteristics of deficiency.
Right.
So we'll get together and attempt to fulfill this deficiency. Sometimes, of course, we will need to go out of the we to get even more of what we're lacking because neither one of us is capable of fulfilling that deficiency since we both lack the same thing.
That's right.
And
I thought I was going to get it all from you. When I realized I can't, of course I'm going to have to get it someplace else, because really what I'm trying to do, right, is to fulfill that deficiency.
Exactly. And so if we're both at the belongingness level, then all of a sudden we find ourselves in a guru, in some sort of cultic endeavor.
Right.
And we are finding our deficiency met there. If we're at self-actualization and we can't get that fulfilled, then all of a sudden we find ourselves constant workshop hopping. Workshop
That's right.
work is great, but if you're doing it as a mere substitute, as a deficiency, then it's something that's just not ever going to really work for you. And so we find ourselves in this we space is all of a sudden now defined by its latest workshop, which is
it becomes the workshop addiction.
Exactly, a workshop addiction and so on. And so all of that can happen when the we space eventually gets invaded by the deficiencies of the individual eyes. And that can take a year to 3 or 4 years, but it will inevitably happen. And then there's a shift in that relationship, and one of two things happens. They either both are still at the same level, in which case they will go in search of deficiency satisfiers together, or one person grows a level and starts looking for their deficiency at a higher level, and now all of a sudden they'll wake up and, you know, look at each other and go, you know, I don't really know you, do I?
Right.
I don't even
right.
know who you are.
Right.
You keep saying these things. You keep talking things. I don't even recognize you. You used to never say stuff like that. We used to, you know, be so together.
Right.
Now all of a sudden you're saying all this stuff. I don't. You know, frankly, I can't do this relationship
right.
anymore.
And this estrangement and this ennui and this alienation sets in.
Yes, exactly.
Which is so painful. It's like the death of Ibn Ilyich. You know, that great, you know, that sense of profound alienation. The person doesn't know what to do with it because they're operating from this place of separate self and deficiency in which alienation is the inevitable conclusion.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In second tier, of course, all that's different because there's a prior recognition, a mutual recognition that whatever we're going to call it, there's some sort of self or spirit that is being mutually expressed here. And
right.
so we have a relationship because there's something higher operating in both
right.
of us. And so it's not just dependent upon me, and it's not just dependent upon you. And we are here in this relationship because when we are together, it helps us recognize that one spirit more than when we're alone. And so we get even more fulfilling. We feel even fuller. We get more superabundant when we're with each other in an apparently contradictory, but not
right.
really contradictory fashion.
Right.
Because what's happening is it's just resonating with this higher self, resonating with this higher spirit. And the only reason people will fall apart then is if they now have kind of an implicit pact to grow together. And if one of them stops growing and the other continues, then there can be a disjointed we space. And
right.
it'll be generally in a friendly way and with tolerance and care and still even love in a certain sense. But that couple will eventually end up splitting up because one of them has just grown beyond the other one.
And that, I mean, would you just, that? I'm going to pick up on that last phrase, Ken. I just love the phrase because it's so important. I want to actually maybe bring some lineage, you know, into
yeah.
this. You know,
yeah.
it's just so beautiful, right? That divorce, actually, when you look at the original texts, you know, in, you know, many of the lineages, and I'll particularly go here to the Hebrew mystical lineage, right? The way they say it is, the way that you enter in holiness, you leave in holiness. Because if that's not true, and it actually wasn't kiddushin, which is the Hebrew word, means you were never in the realm of the sacred to start with.
Right.
And what that's so deeply and profoundly saying is that if actually we entered into a space of the sacred, which is the space that we realize, you know, that we are baby-faced divines, however you understand that, that we're looking at each other, that love means to see the other with God's eyes.
Right.
That's really what love means. Then what happens is that if we come to a space where we're no longer able to unfold and grow together in the way that we needed to,
right.
then we actually don't lose, right, the common God space that lives in both of us.
Right.
And since we don't lose that space, we're able actually to separate in a way, right, which actually honors first the fullness of the time that we had together.
Right.
Which honors, you know, the 1,000 points of love and light, you know, that we had together.
Right.
And which actually supports, you know, the further evolutionary integral growth of the other. And in that sense, you know, an authentic and sacred divorce, right, paradoxically can become an enormously holy moment. And not that we're militating for it or against it. You know, in other words, at second tier, right, the idea of a kind of committed relationship for life is something that we also honor and, you know, enormously in its gorgeousness. And we understand that there are multiple possibilities, and that when people actually do come to the end of this stage of their journey together and they do it in a mutual way, then paradoxically, the parting, right, can be as glorious, right, and as holy. You know, as holy as the coming together, and it's very, very different than a separate self world in which the wedding is this huge feast. You know, we invite, you know, the entire world, and there's this incredible sense of joy and ecstasy. And, you know, in the divorce, you find your one close friend that you're not so embarrassed to be with, you know, when you're in court by yourself and go get drunk afterwards.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
It's unbelievably true. So if there's a genuine miracle of we, then, I mean, you know, Sally, you know, our friend Sally Kempton sometimes says it very nicely, that in a genuine love relationship, there's a commitment to stay in a loving relationship even when the forms of the relationship change, which might mean divorce. It might mean we're no longer going to actually be married, but actually, since love isn't just an egoic fulfillment, then I can actually still perceive and see you in your infinite gorgeousness as true self, and then as the unique expression of your true self, even if I don't own you.
Yeah, and that's such an important point to bring up, because what we're dealing with now that we have, I mean, everybody kind of understands that this marriage thing where you promise to be together, you know, forever was invented when the average lifespan was 35. And you might get married, you know, at 25, and so a good 10 years is a good, you know, forever. And now, with lifespans lasting till 75 or 85, forever has started to come to mean quite a different thing. And I think it's entirely reasonable that men and women, if they create their vows for their relationships, say, you know, and may all of these vows hold for as long as this particular relationship stays in place.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it's committed when it comes in, it's committed when you go out. It's an expression of love when you went in, it's an expression of love when you go out. And I think, frankly, I think 7 years is a pretty good foreverness for today's world. I hear a couple that's together, you know, 7 years, and I go, that's good. That way to go. That's something.
Without giving people a sense, you know, of, you know, utter failure, because paradoxically, what also happens in, I mean, there's a number of shifts. One is, of course, you know, which you point out is longevity. So till death do us part, you know, is much longer, you know, when you're not dying at 30. Right.
Yeah.
So that's one. And two is the sense of growth that's a genuine possibility in a person's life, right, is actually very dramatic. And if a person, you know, lives, you know, a full life, you know, they may leave one tradition for another tradition because they're not bound by their birth tradition. They may move to a different country. Right? They may come into a whole other set of understandings, which is why, you know, if we would have a kind of integral prescription for, you know, if you're interested in a long-term relationship, I think it would be, you know, it used to be, you know, the family that prays together stays together.
Right.
You know, I think now it's the couple that grows together stays together.
Well, exactly. And again, even people that are second tier can be expected to grow at different rates. Now, some of them will stay just sort of right together, and that's fine. But we're basically, both of us are arguing to make room in a couple's life for couples that do grow at different rates.
Right.
Which, you know, is sort of more the general rule than the exception.
That's
right. And then what happens when you have an understanding that, you know, we're going to be together as long as we both can look in each other's eyes and feel that special self and feel that we are bringing that out in each other and feel that that is the commitment that we're being true to. As long as we can do that, we'll be together. When we start not being able to do that, it's not going to be, because the very nature of second and third tier, it's not going to be a viciously rancorous or, you know, brutally natural thing, because it's got this extraordinary tolerance built into it. But it will be, you know, I just don't feel we're growing at the same rate. I don't feel, you know, you want to go to that seminar this weekend. And, you know, honestly, sweetheart, I passed that 2 years ago.
Right.
And I just can't see doing that anymore. And then you sit down and there is love going out of the relationship as well. And then what's so important there is that then what usually happens in most first-tier divorces is the things that are said during the divorce absolutely negate every positive thing that happened to them during a wedding. They will say such vicious and far-reaching things that all of the true love that was reaching down and touching them will just get sucked out of their
That was really real during all those periods. That's right.
It was real. It gets sucked out of their system, and they just get desiccated and negated. And all the growth they did together and all the real love that there was there, all of that just gets completely pulled out and stomped on. And this way, there's an honoring and a cherishing. And, you know, I still see you, and I will have love in my heart for you as long as I ever live.
Right.
And now let us carry on our growth in our own, you know, particular ways.
Yeah, no, it's so fantastic. I mean, in you know, as we move towards a close, you know, in Hebrew, the word for love, ahava, the root word is a two-letter root, which is hav. And hav means to give. You know, it means giving. Love at its core as not an act of deficiency, as an act of giving. And, of course, in the evolution of love, it's what I give that changes at each level.
Right.
The giving itself evolves. You know, and if I can cite our friend Diane Hamilton, you know, like we cited Sally, because Diane, Sally, and I are together with you and Rob as we're working on the design team to unfold Integral Spiritual Experience 2. One of the things that Diane and I do in teaching is we'll talk about love as giving, you know, in a kind of Dharma way, and then Dai will facilitate going up the chakras as levels of consciousness to kind of see how giving happens at a different level at each chakra.
Right.
And that's really our understanding. If you actually come into, you know, an integral spiritual experience, you know, which is about love, you're not just coming for great Dharma and theory, although you're going to get the most cutting edge, off the charts, beautiful Dharma and theory.
Right.
You're not just coming for an experience of I am, of true self, but you're actually coming to participate together with us, you know, in the creation of a Sangha, in the creation of the miracle of we, you know, as the integral evolutionary tribe comes together and studies together, minds together, and loves each other in the most expanded, deep, and powerful and profound way. And oh my God, like what a gathering.
Well, exactly. And then you learn not only to exist at all levels of being, but to give at all levels of being.
Yes.
So you're overriding even deficiency levels with abundance levels. And that's one of the sort of major points that we come away with, is the profound transformative effect that love has on all preceding levels of awareness.
Right.
And, you know, can literally convert them from deficiency into abundance. And have that live as your being.
And have that, I mean, that's a fantastic place to kind of bring this to its fruition, to the conversion from deficiency to abundance, and have that live as your being.
So
this is completely fantastic. And just to give people as we finish the dialogue, just a sense, and we'll be talking more with Ken, you know, throughout the dialogue series. We're going to do a major dialogue with, you know, Mega Pandit Ken at the end of the series, just to really look at everything we've talked about. And for those of you who are kind of listening into Integral Spiritual Experience 2, we're going to really look at, you know, how love changes based on your state of consciousness, how it changes based on your level, how types, masculine and feminine, you know, play, how different lines of development, you know, profoundly affect a relationship.
Right.
We're going to talk about it from the perspective of true self and unique self, false self, you know, separate self. And there's really going to be here just a genuine, you know, gathering of Sangha, you know, a genuine, with the grace of God in first, second, and third person, a genuine realization of Buddha, and a real unfolding of the Dharma of love, the evolution of love. And, you know, Ken, just a huge, you know, bow, love, huge love to you. Huge love to you. You know, that's, you know, what a
love
better,
you
know.
You. Love to you, my friend. Love to you, my friend. And may this be the beginning of many, many more words, hopefully of wisdom, to come.
Amen. Thank you, Ken.
Okay, thank you, buddy.
Deep bye.